Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Eric Elliott. Eric is the author of the book Programming JavaScript Applications, published by O'Reilly. He is the co-founder of the software mentorship platform devanywhere.io and VP of Engineering at Poet, a shared open universal ledger designed to record metadata and ownership information for digital creative assets. He has contributed to software experience for Adobe Systems, Zumba Fitness, The Wall Street Journal, ESPN, BBC, and top recording artists including Usher, Frank Ocean, Metallica, and many more. And now to the conversation with Eric Elliott. Hi, Eric, and many thanks for taking time today.
Yeah, no problem.
Eric, you've been a software developer basically your whole life, and you've been predicting the future also basically your whole life. And I've seen a lot of your writings, especially on JavaScript online, but now you're working on blockchain technology at a company called Poet. Let's maybe start with what Poet does.
Sure. So Poet is building the verifiable web, which is basically we record metadata, data about data. And there's been an effort for a long time, since the early 90s, in fact, to build trust into the information that we see online. It got its initial start with a program called Pretty Good Privacy, which allowed authors to cryptographically sign their creative output. And it was mainly used just to sign emails, so you could be sure that the sender of the email was in fact the person that authored the text that you're reading. It turns out that didn't really take off. There was built a little bit of a community around it, and there were meetups and things like that where people would build this web of trust. And what they meant by that was people knew each other, they trusted each other, and then those people trusted other people. So you could sort of say that because you trust Joe and Joe trusts Echo, that you can trust Echo, right? And that sort of built the foundations of what is now becoming the verifiable web. The verifiable web works on these documents, JSON LD documents that are just basically linked metadata. So it's kind of like the current web, where we have hyperlinks to, like, some source might link to some other source, and that might give it some credibility, which is kind of the whole basis of Google's search algorithm. Except that now these links, you can actually verify that every bit of information contained in these documents was actually authored by the people who say they authored it. And it makes it a lot harder to fake things and inject malicious content and things like that. So it's basically building more trustworthy foundation for content on the web.
So basically, if the Pope says he endorses someone, then you can see that he really did.
Yes. And this is becoming a much bigger issue today because of advances in AI that make it basically possible for somebody to create a photorealistic rendering of video clips of famous people saying things that those famous people never said, right? And there's a famous these are called deep fakes. And there's a famous deep fake where the president is basically talking about these issues. And there are deep fakes going around of all kinds of people saying all kinds of things that they never said. So it's really important that we can trust and verify our sources. So that's one of many applications of the blockchain, is that we can actually take these things and timestamp them and say these things happen at this certain time. But the technology that's been around for a very long time, for several decades now, well, a few decades now, is the ability to cryptographically sign all of the content that you create. So you can kind of create a little digital signature that says, I actually said this, and you can verify that this is true because this is my public key, and you can check with my official sources that this is indeed my public key, and you can see that it's signed with it.
Okay, cool. I mean, let me just make sure I understand what you just said. Basically, with PGP, pretty good privacy, I could do something similar just with my email, though, right? Where I could basically have an email signature attached to an email that I'm sending to you, and you could see that it's really coming from me. But the issue, I think, why it never took off is it was just so cumbersome to use, and very, very few people actually used it. So how is the solution that you just described, how is that different and better than PGP in that regard?
So now there are some of this technology, some of the signature technology, well, not signatures, but some of the cryptographic technology behind these things is actually being baked into web browsers today. So it's going to just be a default part of the web browsing experience that that we're expecting a specific hash of content. And a hash is basically a fingerprint for digital content. Each piece of digital content can be hashed in various ways to produce a deterministic fingerprint that you're going to get every single time you try to hash that content. And you can check that hash against the content itself. So you can rehash the content, compare it to the hash that you're expecting. If there's no match, then it'll just discard it, throw it away, and say this didn't match, or throw an error or something like that. And that technology is already being built into web browsers. So it's going to become a default part of the web browsing experience. The reason that PGP didn't really take off is because these things never really got built into our email technology. There were lots and lots of different email clients, and there weren't a lot that supported this stuff by default. And I think that if it had been built into the client technology at the email software layer, I think it would have been a very different story. I think people would have had a good user experience where they could see like a little check mark, this is verified, or even better than those like positive marks is like a negative indicator, like a warning that says, this is not verified, be careful with this content, they might be trying to trick you. I think those are the kinds of experiences that we're going to start to see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the privacy, the data privacy debate, you know, that's also currently going on. And I mean, even there, I see it's very, very hard to get people to agree that privacy is important and that their online behavior is not private at all. So how do you think can you get people to care about a verifiable web?
I don't think that we get people to care about a verifiable web because caring is not enough. Even if they do care, they're going to feel powerless about it. So what we need to do as technologists is just build it into the platform as a feature of our future applications. And then it doesn't matter if they care or not. They just get the benefits of it regardless. And the way that we get developers to care is we just build it into the culture. It's like, this is an indicator of quality. And if you don't meet this bar, then people are not going to use your app, right? They're not going to use your stuff because, so for instance, fairly soon, you won't be able to visit old HTTP websites that are not served over HTTPS anymore, at least not easily, right? It won't be just like visiting them has always been. It'll be like, you'll get warnings. This site is not secure. You should be very careful here. And the reason for that is because it's really easy to hijack those those sessions and kind of inject stuff that wasn't supposed to be there. So it's really important that even sites that don't collect form data or, you know, don't take credit cards or whatever, they should all be using HTTPS in order to avoid situations like that. And I think that if we build a developer culture where we have certain expectations for security and how we treat our users' data, and then apps and companies that don't meet those expectations just don't get used, or our user agents warn the users about them. They warn them that this is a danger zone. You should probably stay away.
I mean, that ties into this whole debate about why nobody's using decentralized applications, right? And basically what you're saying is if they were just baked into the woodwork of the normal infrastructure that people use anyway, people would use them, but currently they're not. So also I read somewhere, I think in a Medium post that you wrote, that, you know, some of these dApps, right, have very, very low user numbers, but you wrote there that that's okay, actually, currently. So maybe, can you explain?
Yeah. So we're going to go through kind of a long, it's going to feel like to the developers, it's going to feel like a long, arduous process, because until we get to a critical mass of users, it's going to be difficult for us, because driving user adoption is the only way for us to find product market fit before our runway is run out, before the money stops, right? So there's going to be a tough challenge for the next couple of years where we're building all this technology into our browsers so that we can support decentralized apps better. And until that happens, user adoption is going to be a really serious issue for us. Simply because right now the user interfaces for signing transactions and things like that are really obnoxious. They just don't work well at all. And key management is a really hard problem for end users, right? And users don't want to be writing down these long, complicated keys and sticking them in their safes at home. And like the process, the on-ramp here, the price of admission for getting an end user to start using your app is just way too high right now. So what we're going to start to see is like online identity solutions with key custody and automatic signing and daily budgets that are allowed and things like that. And those kinds of things, those custody agents, a lot of people in the decentralized ecosystem will say, hey, that's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid this situation where these centralized actors have access to all this data. But in reality, what's going to happen is that users are going to flock to them for the same reason that they flock to banks. Like, they trust these people to manage their bank accounts. They don't want to do all the math themselves, right? They don't want to take care of safeguarding their own money in their own homes, because that introduces other kinds of security risks, like people breaking into your house and trying to steal your safe, right? So there are trade-offs between being truly truly self-sovereign and having a good customer experience or good user experience. There are trade-offs, and we need to find the right balance for users. And the right balance for users is not necessarily the ideological decentralize all the things. It might be like there are still trusted agents, but now users have choices between various trusted agents, and maybe they trust them with a little bit less, and like maybe they trust them with their daily browsing budgets, right? But they don't necessarily trust them with the whole bank account, right?
I mean, it's definitely way earlier, I think, then, you know, many of, you know, companies that may have raised, you know, lots of money in ICO want to make users believe. And obviously, you've also heard that. I mean, this, it's 1998, right, in terms of the internet age, but it's probably much earlier than that.
I think it's much earlier than that. Yeah. So from the virtual machine technology perspective, we're still in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm. When there were no computers, basically.
Yeah, what I mean by that is the CPU power that we actually have in smart contracts and our ability to process smart contract information and store smart contract information on those virtual machines. It still costs over $1 million per gigabyte to store data on Ethereum. So that's like way back 60s, 70s era, right? But we're in the 90s in terms of like investment in this space. So there's a lot of excitement from investors. Right now, investors still outweigh the number of developers in the ecosystem. And there's more investors throwing money into this ecosystem than there are developers building products in this ecosystem still. Mm. So we're in this like really exciting early investment era, but think of it this way, we're building the web, right? But the web browser hasn't been invented yet. So we're, in terms of like internet technology, we are pre-web browser. In the very early 90s, there were kind of competing hyperlink technologies and competing content platform technologies. There was Telnet, which was very widely used. There was a menu-driven thing called Gopher, and then the web came out right around that time, the very early 90s, and that's where we are today. We're at like the very early phases of the web browsing technology, like the very first version of web browsers for decentralized apps. And what I mean by decentralized apps is more of a modern crypto industry take on it, where there is a value exchange possible. So we're talking about the internet of value here. Actual like monetary-ish transactions can take place where tokens can be exchanged and the actual ownership of those tokens changes hands. And that allows for a new kind of economy on the web where protocols can be self-sustaining. They don't need a company behind them because the community who's using that protocol can actually pay for the network resources required to sustain it. And that's what I mean by really decentralized apps, is where there's no centralized entity that could collapse and then take the whole ecosystem down because the network can't sustain itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Maybe no human entity also.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. It's interesting. I mean, I often have the impression that we're looking at all of this development in blockchain technology and other deep tech, you know, vectors like AI and data science. We're looking at this through an old lens. So how important do you think blockchains will be, you know, maybe together with other of these more disruptive technologies like AI, AR, drones, etc.?
All right. So first, we have to kind of close our eyes and imagine, right? Imagine the VR, the big, clunky, obnoxious VR goggles that you see everywhere. Imagine those are the size of a regular pair of glasses, and you could wear them virtually all day, every day, and they would not get in your way, and you would forget they're there. That reality is coming very soon. And when it does, and by very soon, I mean 5-10 years probably, to start to see real adoption, real consumer adoption. When that time does come, then a lot of things are going to change with it. That's going to fundamentally change the human experience. We're already kind of part cyborg. We've always got our cell phones with us, right? And our cell phones provide extra sensory input to our brains, right? They have vibration. They've got a screen we can look at and get data from. They've got speakers, and like it's becomes like an extension of us. We can, if we need some information, we don't just rely on our physical biological memory anymore. We look up Google, right? We can call on an assistant, a virtual assistant, go and fetch the data for us. That input will be literally on our face all day long, every day. So we're not going to lose our cell phone. It's going to be like attached to our face, right? The whole idea of physical screens is going to disappear. There won't be any need for physical screens anymore, because you can call up a gigantic movie theater size screen anywhere you are at any time. And that's going to radically change the human experience in a lot of ways. One of the interesting ways that it'll change that experience is that we could literally conjure anything at any time, and it can become part of our reality. So people are calling this augmented reality or mixed reality, or I think some people are just giving up on all these different acronyms and just calling it immersive technology now. But what's going to happen is that this digital reality and our real world interactions are going to merge and become quite literally indistinguishable from each other. In the future, you'll have to like actually turn it off to be able to tell the difference between what's real and what's not real anymore, right? You'd have to take the glasses off your face in order to tell what's real and what's not real. And this raises a lot of interesting questions, but it raises a lot of opportunities. Like, for instance, what if art and collectibles could become like really like more like physical things that actually hold value? I'm looking at a limited edition photographic print, number 32 of 200, hanging on my wall right now. It's a photograph of Slash playing guitar.
Cool.
Things like that can be represented in digital form, and they can be actually rare, actually collector's items, because they can be signed by the artist who created them, using those same signatures we were talking about to verify, I really did send this email. You can have a signature on a piece of art that says, I really did create this artwork. This is an original. This is a limited edition. There's only 10 of these in existence, or one of these in existence. And that makes it valuable, right? And that makes it collectible. So things like digital collectibles are going to transform the world for creators, influencers. Anybody who can build a fan base is going to be able to make a better living by selling things like that, and selling unique experiences for their fans. And I think that that's going to be transformative in that it'll open up a lot of opportunities for people to make a living who are currently struggling to make a living, because what happened with the rise of the internet is that everything became free. Right. When everything is free, that means nobody's getting paid. Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. So what happened in the music industry was that their income streams were pretty much decimated around the year 2000.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it. I mean, just a little side note. I mean, I actually used to be a music producer, mm-hmm. and I had a deal with Universal Music. And I was told later that deal was made in 2005, that it was one of the last bigger deals mm-hmm. in history, because after that, just sales totally tanked.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've seen that happen, front row seat. But then again, you know, immediately there was a huge shakeup in the whole industry. But now there's much more music being listened to and sold, you know, than ever before.
Yeah.
So it didn't go away completely, but it just changed in ways that we couldn't foresee and that nobody could wrap their head around back then.
But what really went away was the idea of making a living by selling the music recordings.
Yeah. Right?
That that really did go away. That's a very small, it's still, people still sell recordings, but now they're selling like vinyls, right? Are responsible for a bigger share of music sales than they have been since vinyls were first big.
Well,
right?
Scarce value, right? Scarcity. That was the whole big thing back then.
Exactly.
And so people started making limited editions and, you know, hand painted and signed CDs and stuff like that.
Yep.
But anyway, I digress.
Even with that, there aren't enough people buying vinyl records because it's just not a very convenient thing to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
It's number one, it's way more expensive than a lot of fans can afford. And number two, they have to like worry about shipping and is it going to warp in transit and things like that. I actually collect a little bit of vinyl myself, and I love the medium as like a showcase and like art pieces and stuff. But I mostly listen to music streaming these days. Like I don't pull them out. I keep them in their containers, kind of preserved, right, in their sleeves. And I don't like to put them on the record on the turntable because I don't want them to get scratched or damaged or anything like that. So I just listen on my music players.
Yeah. But do you see then, just to tie this into, you know, the question that I originally asked, you know, with blockchains, how important is that in that reality that you're describing there with the creators?
So when it comes to blockchain technology, this new idea of transferring ownership digitally, like this completely digital thing being owned by one person and then you sell it to somebody else and then somebody else owns it, you don't have the original anymore. Somebody else owns it now, right? That idea of ownership transfer is the big innovation that Bitcoin heralded. That was the thing that made Bitcoin special. They solved the double spending problem, which was in a digital world, if you send somebody a copy of something, you still have the original, right? So there's no such thing as scarcity anymore. And if there's no such thing as scarcity, there's no such thing as collectibles. There's no such thing as value for information.
Exactly.
Right? But that doesn't track because information is obviously valuable. We all value it a great deal. So it's really interesting now that we can actually attach value to something and that value is real, right? And there's a whole ecosystem of people selling specialty items that they found in online video games to each other. And there's like this, there's an underground marketplace where people exchange items, rare items from video games with each other all the time. So this is actually a huge industry. This whole idea of digital scarcity is a big deal. It allows an economy to form, a new kind of economy that's never been possible before. The fact that anybody can create these kinds of digital items means that anybody can go into business if they've got a computer and access to the internet. Then they can go into business and make a living, which is a really good thing, really powerful.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
There's the idea of like with all these things being created, how do you sort them out? How do you find the good stuff, right? And that's another place where artificial intelligence has an obvious answer, right? Where right now it probably seems laughable because maybe you don't enjoy all your Netflix recommendations or your YouTube, what video should you watch next kind of recommendations. But these technologies are getting exponentially better as time goes on. And pretty soon we're going to see artificial intelligence play a really great role in terms of like assisting you in finding the kinds of things that you actually enjoy. And that's going to play a big role too. So we're going to have this combination of artificial intelligence and blockchain technology providing value transfer and kind of building the foundations of the internet of value. And all of this is going to come together in really interesting ways because things like technology like 3D printing is really taking off. Drones are going to start delivering stuff to people soon, right? They're already delivering things to people in various remote locations, but as regulations get changed and updated for the modern era, you're going to start to see drone deliveries in cities across the United States become more and more common. And things are going to change in a lot of interesting ways that are going to have a really big impact on what it means to be human. We're really becoming more of a cybernetic organism where technology is becoming more and more a real part of our existence and our experience.
I think technology has always been a part of our experience, right? It's just that this time around, technology actually has the power to have an initiative on its own with AI. And so I think that's quite unforeseen. I want to ask one more thing about music. And the reason I bring this up is I read that you also were working with music artists on software, like guys like Frank Ocean, Usher, Metallica, but also the BBC and ESPN. You know, these big stars or these big media companies, how open do you see them have an attitude toward blockchain technologies?
So I think artists are extremely open to it because they want to see additional ways that they can earn a living and that they can get paid for the work that they do. So I think that for them, it's just another way to connect with their fans and to build the living, earn the living that they need to keep doing what they do. Right. Right now, a lot of people who would be great musicians potentially, and like the next Mozarts and the next Metallica, a lot of them are not going into music professionally right now because it's a really hard road. And I think these technologies can make that road a lot easier, which hopefully will enrich us with more great music and great art. And I think we can support a lot more musicians because it doesn't take a huge fan base. If you have a few thousand dedicated fans, you can earn a living. It doesn't take a huge fan base to earn a living if you have ways to get paid, right? If you have ways that those fans can funnel income to you, right? And if they're right in the early 2000s, the big problem was people loved music. They wanted to share the music. They wanted to support the people that they were fans of, right? But the music industry wasn't giving them any valid ways to do that, which is, it's just ridiculous. The music industry kind of buried their heads in the sand and thought, well, if we fight back hard enough, this whole internet thing will go away, mm-hmm. right? They learned the hard way that that's not how technology works,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
You have to work with technology. You have to find ways to make that technology work for you. And I think that what's going to happen is we're going to find a lot more ways that the technology can work for artists and fans alike and make it a mutually beneficial relationship again. Whereas in the early 2000s, it was more of a one-sided relationship where the fans were just gobbling up all the music they could find for free and the artists weren't getting paid. And I don't think either the fans or the artists were really happy with that arrangement. The fans aren't happy because their favorite artists stop making music or they like dig their heels in and say, I'm not going to be on this streaming platform for like a decade. Like I think the Beatles took a long time to join the streaming community, right?
That didn't, you know, prevent their music from being shared online for free though.
No, it didn't. It didn't, right? Like Metallica raised a big fuss in the early 2000s where Lars, especially from Metallica, kind of a spokesperson for artist rights. And he wasn't entirely wrong, right? A lot of fans were enjoying the music for free and they weren't supporting the artists. However, like the big problem wasn't the fans. It was the fact that the recording industry didn't give the fans a valid way to support the artists. They didn't give them a way that made sense to the fans to support the artists, right? They're still trying to sell CDs, and the fans are like, I'm done with CDs. All my music is on my MP3 player now, right? I don't carry a CD player around with me, but I've got this MP3 player constantly by my side. And even if I liked CDs, like, I can't carry around that many CDs. I want to carry around 10,000 songs in my pocket, right? And I can't do that with CDs.
So, I mean, Metallica famously sued Napster, right?
Yeah.
And they actually brought down Napster. But instead, do you think they should have maybe bought Napster and, you know, integrated it in their distribution model?
I don't think they would have known what to do with it, right? I think the right play would have been to figure out, well, what can we do that that we can charge money for that adds value while we still provide these MP3 downloads? Like, mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that happened is in those early days, there were other groups running experiments, like Nine Inch Nails released stuff exclusively digital and had free and pay what you want kinds of things and like extra collectible things. And some of those early experiences were tremendously successful just because people wanted to support artists looking for ways to engage the fans on terms that the fans recognized as valid, right? And it has to be a situation that is mutually beneficial or it doesn't work for anybody. It has to work for both parties or nobody is happy.
Yeah. Now, the scenario that you described before with AR, with being immersed in a virtual environment where, you know, it's very, very hard to distinguish what is virtual, what is real. Which current incumbent companies do you think maybe A, don't understand that that's happening and that may be threatening to what they're currently doing to earn money, or B, you know, may want to actively prevent something like this from happening?
So I think a lot of companies are going to be threatened by it. I think we're going to see the same kind of disruption that we saw in the early days of the internet, where I think a lot of brick and mortar or purely physical based companies are going to suffer unless they get on board. But I think that a lot of companies are learning the lessons, maybe haven't learned exactly, but I think a lot of companies are learning the lessons that the music industry learned early on. And that is, if you don't want to be disrupted, if you don't want to go the way of the giant brick and mortar chains that all went out of business, then you need to jump on these technologies and you need to figure out how to embrace them before you get mauled by them.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, you know, that path is littered with stories, right? Like Blockbuster, Kodak, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So where do you see those friction points between what's currently going on with the development in blockchains and, you know, the status quo that we currently have in our economy and society?
Everywhere people are making a lot of money as a middleman, those people are in trouble, right? So anybody taking a big cut out of a financial transaction and that's how they earn their living, those people should watch out. Those people should figure out something else to make a living doing, because it's going to disappear. And I think that that's just in general, if you're sitting in the middle of a transaction and taking a cut, then maybe your job isn't going to exist in the future. And you should be looking for what's next. And I say you should be looking for what's next because you can't fight this stuff. They tried to fight cars with regulations by forcing people to stand out in front of the car, waving this big flag, walking on foot.
Yeah.
That didn't last very long, right? And that's what's going to happen to regulations that are trying to stand in the way of the progress of technology. So regulations can do a little bit, but they can't stop things that are obviously better for everybody from happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, we spoke a lot about artists, right? How they can take advantage of these developments. But what about just, you know, regular employee, you know, maybe working somewhere 9 to 5? What should they do that they won't be, like you said before, mauled by these technologies in the future.
I don't know, learn a different trade. I just want to reemphasize that that this technology is going to be transformative for a lot of people. It's going to create a lot of opportunity. A lot of jobs are going to go away. A lot of companies are going to go away, and a lot of people are going to be hit hard by it. But I think that the new opportunities created by blockchain technology, digital ledger, distributed ledgers in general, and crypto in general, it's going to vastly outweigh any of the scary stuff that's coming. There's just so much potential for example, 30% of the world's population, or the US population, 30% is unbanked. And just the fact that we're going to allow people who have not previously had access to any kind of financial technology, now they have an avenue to get on board and join us in the digital economy. I think that's going to be transformative in so many ways that I think that the future is very, very bright. It's very, very bright for content creators and musicians and artists and movie makers and anybody in creative fields. Things have been tough for the last couple of decades, but they're going to get much better because of this technology in the very near future. And I'm really looking forward to that future.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I mean, I know you have to go. And last question you can answer with just one word. But what is the most important skill for the future?
Coding.
Okay, good. Many thanks, Eric. This was a really fascinating conversation. And I really appreciate your taking time today.
Me too. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.